It's great to be with you. I spent quite a bit of time in Dallas, named George Truett. Was known to everybody, at least in Baptist circles. And I'm delighted to be at the seminary. And delighted also to be part of this lectureship in the honor of a young man who served Jesus Christ here in Waco and did so effectively. What a wonderful way to be remembered. Not a statue, not a plaque, but a time in which year after year we talk about preaching. You can look at preaching in a lot of different ways. One way we ought to look at it is that we're in competition with ideas. If you go into the marketplace, there are all kinds of people spreading their doctrine and getting across their philosophy. Over there is the Marxists. They used to have a lot bigger crowd than they do now. They translated their philosophy into the economy of communism. Somehow it didn't work too well. Crowd has dwindled, but it's still there, Marxism. Go to Africa, go to Asia. There are those who still believe that if everybody contributes according to their ability, then everybody should take according to their needs. Only thing they didn't figure in was the human condition. And if you don't believe in depravity, you can come up with all kinds of lovely philosophies. Over there, there's philosophy of Islam. It has replaced Judaism as the second largest faith represented in our country. Strong around the world. And whatever else Islam is, it's ideas. Ideas by which people live, ideas for which people die. The largest crowd is this crowd back here. They're the materialists. They believe that your life consists of the things that you possess. It's by far the largest group in the marketplace and most influential. They've got everything going for them. Thumb through a magazine and you see the philosophy in four color ads. It's the word from the sponsor on television. It's sung to you in jingles on the radio. In the first world, people measure success by how many things they have. More things, more successful. In the emerging world, when we say that, you know, they're looking for a better life, they're not talking about a better philosophy. They're talking about more things. In the churches in which we minister, it is undoubtedly the dominant philosophy of the people who come to hear us. Now, suddenly, when some of those things have been snatched away from them, you come to realize that how important all that was. But in this marketplace, we have a platform. And we're presenting ideas to people. Christianity is more than ideas, but it's not less than ideas. Tough competition. Most of the ideas by which people live, by which people love, for which people die, are not communicated directly. the battle we fight is not fought up here where ideas are presented and we can evaluate them. Now, most of the ideas of the folks up here come in subliminally. They come in under the guard. And especially the materialists understand that. They don't ever come to you and say, look, the mark of your success is how many things you've been able to accumulate. But they tell you that again and again. Subliminally, people embrace those ideas, and those ideas determine their lives. Ideas. Years ago, when Marlboro cigarettes came out, they were a cigarette marketed for women, and they didn't sell. So they, as far as I can tell, that was the first market research ever done. They wanted to find out why people smoked. And they discovered that the men smoked because they thought it made them masculine. Women smoked because they thought it made them attractive to men. So they changed their whole ad campaign. You had the Marlboro Man. He's sitting on a horse. He's out in the middle of Wyoming in winter bringing in cabs. Doesn't say in there, smoke Marlboro. He says that. And even though down here in writing it says, the Surgeon General says you smoke these things, you're going to die, somehow it doesn't make its mark. It became one of the three top brands. Interesting, isn't it, that just recently, Congress got into the act. They called the people in the cigarette company, the leaders, and they said to them, we have research that says that people die because of your cigarettes. I didn't know that, yeah. And so they backed off. You would think, wouldn't you, that if you knew that people were dying because of the product you were selling, they wouldn't touch it again. But you go to other parts of the world and the Marlboro Man is still riding. Even though it's proved that he's dying of cancer and Marlboro Country is a cemetery, still going on. It says that the manufacturers are so determined to get their idea across to you that they'll kill you in order to do it. And here we are, competing with those ideas. Question is, what is an idea? How would you recognize it? If you bumped into one in the dark alley, could you identify it to the police? And I suggest that there are two marks of an idea. Two things you have to have in order to have an idea form in you. One is that an idea has a subject. When I talk about a subject, I'm not talking about subject as you would have it in English grammar. In English grammar, if you had the idea of Acts chapter 2, the great sermon, it's a God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. So if you know your English grammar and you say, well, what's the subject? It's God. Well, Peter, what did you preach about on the Pentecost? I preached on God. Yeah, right. Now, when we talk about a subject, we're talking about the full, well-defined answer to the question, what are you talking about? And the complement that completes it, that fills it out, is the answer to that question. So in Acts 2, the subject is, what has God done with Jesus whom the people crucified? And the complement is, he has made him Lord and Christ. Subject. If that doesn't work for you, you can turn it into a question and an answer. Every subject can be stated as a question. Every compliment as an answer. You remember in grade school, they taught you that bit of doggerel, I have six faithful men who taught me all I knew, what and where and when, why and how and who. Six interrogatives. Every subject can be stated as a question. So if subject and complement, what you're talking about, and then what you're completing it with, what you're saying about it doesn't work, try question and answer. When you're trying to examine an idea, when you're trying to decide what it is you're preaching, what's the question? What's the answer? All of that's kind of fuzzy in a night like this. So let's try a few of them. See if we can nail them down. And to start, let's look at the book of Proverbs. I take them because they're small. They're easy to get hold of. Look at Proverbs 22. A good name is more desirable than great riches, the verse says, first verse. To be esteemed is better than silver or gold. So if I ask you, what is the subject of that little proverb? What's it talking about? What's the question? The answer to my question is, I'll let you answer some in a minute, is what's the value of a good reputation? It's the subject. That's the question. What's the value of a good reputation? The compliment is, it's more valuable and silver or gold. Okay? Subject, compliment, question, answer. Or look at the second one. Rich and poor have this in common. The Lord is the maker of them all. So what do you think the subject of that is? What's the question behind that proverb? Want to venture a guess? What? Common bond. Yeah, but give me the question. It's talking about the common bond, but what, are you saying what is the common bond? Okay. Okay, what do all people have in common? That is, God made them. Okay. All right, let's try another one. This is a little more difficult. In verse 13. The sluggard, the lazy man, says, there's a lion outside, or I will be murdered in the street. Take just a minute, talk to the person next to you, and try to decide what the subject is. What's that little proverb talking about? What's the question? What's the answer? The sluggard says, there's a lion outside, verse 13, or I will be murdered in the street. Okay, somebody want to venture a guess? What do you think it's talking about? Say it again. Oh, the consequences of being lazy. Okay, That's in the target area. It's not the bullseye. Okay, what's the answer? That's the question. What's the answer? He offers excuses. Yeah. It's based. It doesn't work very well to say, what does the sluggard say? Sluggard says there's a lion outside. I mean, that's keen insight into the obvious. And so what you have to do is to come up and abstract a bit. And so it's, how does a sluggard get out of work? Then the compliment is by making ridiculous excuses. Okay? Subject, compliment, question, and answer. Take one more. We'll go over some other passages of the Bible, but take one other. Look at the Proverbs 21, Proverbs 21, verse 31, last verse. And the horse is made ready for the day of battle, but victory rests with the Lord. What do you think the subject is? What's he talking about? And what's the compliment? What's he saying about that? What's the question? What's the answer? I'm not hearing very well up here. How is victory achieved? Oh, okay, sorry. Thank you. And the compliment? What do you think it's saying? What's the answer? You're onto it, but it's not quite. Okay, tell me that again. Proper preparation. Give me a question. Make it a question for me. Okay, and what's your answer? Yeah, how... What do you depend upon when facing a difficult opportunity? You depend upon your preparation, but most of all, you depend upon the Lord. Something of that sort. Okay, let's take another passage. Look over in the book of James. Bible, as we have it, is filled with paragraphs. A paragraph, by definition, is a basic unit of thought. The reason that you have little proverbs in paragraph form, as we just looked at it, is that each proverb is a unit of thought. But by definition, a paragraph is a unit of thought. And the paragraphs we have, as you know, were not in the original manuscripts. Paper was valuable in the ancient world. So they didn't waste time on white space. But editors have come along and divided the passages into what they think are thought sections. It's interesting, if you look at a Bible that was translated in the 19th century, 1800s, paragraphs are longer. Not unusual to discover that verses 2 through 12 are one paragraph. But when you look at the NIV, you find it's got into three paragraphs, four paragraphs. So who's right? And the answer to that is they're both right. The reason that more modern translations are broken into smaller thought units is they're easier to read. It's very hard to read a full, long paragraph of 12 verses and get it. So they divide it into shorter units. Not each unit is equal. You have a unit of thought, but you remember, if you think of an outline, you have a Roman numeral, and the Roman numeral is a unit of thought. The A under that one is a unit of thought. The B is a unit of thought. Then if you have a little one under the B, that's another unit of thought. So not all thought units are of the same value, but they are all ideas. Make sense? So what I'd like to do is to do what an editor does. I'd like to divide this into some paragraphs. First paragraph I would like you to look at is James 1, verses 2 through 4. James 1, 2 to 4. If you can, have somebody work with you on this. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. That's the thought you need. What do you think the subject is? What do you think the compliment is? Take a minute to talk to the person next to you. See if you can nail it down. Okay, somebody want to take a stab at it? What do you think it's talking about? What's the question? What's the answer? Say it again. I'm having a hard time hearing up here. It's my part, my fault. Try it again. How can one survive in the midst of trials? What's your compliment? Feel good about that? He's courageous. The word is sort of a giveaway in that one is because. You have because almost always the question is why. Okay? So if you look at the first line, count it all joy, my brothers, when you fall into different kinds of trials, If you didn't have the Bible and I just came up to you and said, man, you're going through a tough time. I know, it's really rough. You ought to be delighted. It's wonderful. You'd say to me, why? How could you say that? But it's, why we should rejoice when we have to go through trials. What do you think the answer is? Yeah. You rejoice not because you like trials, but through trials you come to maturity, a richness, a fullness of life. Okay? Now take this. I divide it up into another paragraph, starting at verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. A little longer. Again, what do you think the subject is? What's he talking about? How would you complete it? What's the question? What's the answer? Take a moment, confer with the people around you. Okay, back row, good. Say it again. Okay, and what's the compliment? What's the answer? It's almost the whole sermon, isn't it? Okay, you got to do that kind of thing. Somebody else want to see if we can narrow it down a bit. What do you think the subject is? What do you think the question is? Say it again. And make it a question. How we get wisdom. Okay, what's the compliment? What's the answer to that question? Okay, and is there any qualification to ask God for? Okay, asking God for faith, in faith. Good. Yeah, and I take it the faith is that God's got some purpose to this. So if you need wisdom, insight into the trial, ask God for it. If you were looking at the context that we just looked at, where he's talking about going through trials and so forth, if you were limiting that subject in the light of the context, is how do you get wisdom? Could you limit that a bit? Is this a guarantee of wisdom for anybody, for any situation? When I was going to, as a student, I was in a Christian college. And after the first semester, we had final exams, and the teacher asked one of the students to pray. The student prayed, oh God, help those of us who studied to remember what we studied and those of us who didn't study to remember what we learned in high school. I don't think this is biblical support for that. So if you're trying to nail that down, how to get wisdom, that's right. I mean, it could be more limited. What would it be? How would you limit it? Yeah. Give it to me straight. What's the question? Maybe. If you have a paragraph and it's a basic unit of thought, then it has to have one subject and one complement, one question, one answer. It's the nature of the beast. Okay, the subject you were onto is, you know, how do you get wisdom? But it's, I think, the qualification is, how do you get wisdom in trials? And the compliment is, ask God for it in faith. Okay. It is not just a general problem of wisdom, it's how do you get wisdom from God in the midst of trials? How do you get his insight? If he's doing something, you want to cooperate with the process. So how do you get God's insight, the skill to deal with this? And so how do you get wisdom in trials? And the compliment is you ask God for it in faith that he will give it to you. Okay? Let's take one more, at least one more. Look at verse 12. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. Because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. What do you think the subject and compliment is? What do you think he's talking about? What's he saying about what he's talking about? What do you think the question is? What's the answer? Okay, and what's the compliment? Yeah, good, very good. What is the reward for persevering in trials? And the answer is get the crown of life. You may not know at this stage what the crown of life is. There's more study to be done. Is it like a trophy at the Sunday school picnic? Or is it the crown, which is life? You know, a lot of things there. Okay, I skipped the paragraph. And in look at verses 9 through 11. The brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position. But the one who is rich should also take pride in his low position, because he'll pass away like a wild flower. For the sun rises with the scorching heat and withers the plant, its blossom falls, its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. Now, in the light of the fact that we have been discussing through verses 1 through 8, something about trials, come to 12, to persevere in trials, what do you know about this paragraph, even though you may not know what it means, what it's about? Yeah, it deals with trials. It isn't, you know, the biblical writer doesn't talk about trials and then, oh, I got something else I want to throw in, and he starts over, then comes back. You know it's about trials. Not sure what it is about trials, but you know about it. If you come to the end of the paragraph, verse 8, and says, if you lack wisdom in trials, ask God for it, and he'll give it to you, but ask in faith. What question would you have if, again, if it weren't in the Bible, because by reading the Bible, we sort of look at it through pious eyes, but if I said to you, if you lack insight in your trial, you ask God for it, he'll give it to you. What would you want from me as support for that? What would you ask me? What? Say it again. Yeah, prove it. Yeah, that's good. And I would say to you, all right, let me show it to you. Let me give you an illustration. So here he gives us an illustration of two men. One is a poor man who is rich, and the other is a rich man who really is poor. This brother of low degree can rejoice in the fact that he's got high estate. He's a brother. Now, in any society, poor people are despised. They're looked down upon. So if you end up with a 25-day check and a 31-day month, that happens again and again and again, not only is it a tough way to make a living, but people look down on poor people. They did in the ancient world, they do in our world. But if you're a Christian, a brother, you can rejoice in your high estate. You can get an insight to realize that the trials don't define you. That you're a prince on the way to a kingdom. And even though your circumstances don't look good, you have dignity. On the other hand, if you have wealth, and I take it as a Christian, a brother of low degree, a brother of high degree, if he goes through trials, as people are now, losing everything he has, boy, that's tough. I mean, it's tough to be poor, but it's even tougher to be high on the hog and go down to its hoof. What you discover is, what you have is goes, and you discover about yourself that no matter what you have, you're going to go. And if you get the insight that the money doesn't define you, that's worth the price of admission. Years ago when I was teaching in Dallas, we had a boom there in real estate for about 3 years. And one of the men in the Bible study I was teaching really made it big. Made a lot of money fast. And he made it and he lost it almost overnight. We've seen this lately. He had two beautiful new cars, and he had to sell them in order to pay off his debts. Lived in a lovely house, and you have the homestead law here in Texas. They're not supposed to be able to touch it, but he was honorable enough. He sold the house in order to pay off his debts. Moved into a small bungalow. I mean, it was tough. And I remember he sat in my office, and he said, "That was the toughest experience of my life. I wouldn't want to go through it again. But I'm glad I did. Because on a Tuesday, when I wasn't looking, I somehow switched gods. And I realized, as a result of what has happened to me, that I was trusting in money, and suddenly it failed me. That's good insight. Take that all the way to heaven. So I take it what you have here is an illustration of the principle that he's just given. Illustration, verses 9 through 11. What is the wisdom? What's the insight you can get when you're going through a trial where everything you have is taken away from you, or where you don't have what you need to complete the month? So all I was saying is that when you're reading a paragraph, not all paragraphs are equal. Some are in support of others. Okay, let's try one more, okay? Let's take Psalm 1, different kind of literature, Psalm 1. Blessed is the man or woman who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. All right, get into your groups of two or three and see if you can come up with what you think is the subject and the complement of that psalm. What's he talking about? And then what's he saying about what he's talking about? Say that again, please. Okay, the comparison. Okay. You're onto it. It's a particular comparison if you read the whole psalm. So it's a bit more defined than that. But you're right, it's a comparison between the two. But what is the point of the comparison as the psalm develops? Excuse me? Good. What is the end result of the righteous and the wicked? And the righteous will prosper, the wicked will be destroyed. By the way, what kind of literature is this? Poetry. What's the essence of poetry? I mean, real poetry, not, you know, Mary had a little lamb, its feet were full of soot, and everywhere that Mary went, its sooty foot he put. What's the essence of poetry? What do you do with in a poem? How does it differ, say, from the literature of Book of Romans? Yeah, image. Is that what you said? Oh, meter, yeah. But it's more... It's image, pictures. What's the major picture in this psalm? Tree. Okay. What kind of tree? Tell me about it from what you know in the passage. What kind of a tree? Okay, got firm roots. It blooms. It's steady. And it's by water, constantly fed. What's the other image in the sun. Righteous or chaff. Yeah, chaff. Here today, gone tomorrow. So you have that contrast between something that is permanent, productive, fruitful, and chaff, which is none of those. Okay. So the key to the psalm, if you take those images, is the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. That's the conclusion. It's the final end. If you looked at the first stanza about the righteous man, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. But what is the thing that that man does that makes that person like a tree? Like the kind of tree is being described there. What can you tell me about that? Yeah, nourished by the Lord, Torah. He meditates on it. He takes it in. In contrast, when you think of the wicked, if the righteous man gets his guidance in life from the law, where does the wicked, the unrighteous person, get his direction in life or her direction? Yeah, from the... You don't walk in the counsel of the wicked or stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of mockers. You don't get your lead in life from Oprah or Dr. Phil or from the gossip or from the columns in the newspaper. But the man is blessed, is righteous, who gets the input from the law. That's how poetry works. It's got an image. When you're preaching it, you have to preach the image. People have to see that tree. They have to be able to realize it. This tree that he's describing is rich, full. And then that's true of the man. And you have to discuss what chaff is. People have to see it. Just in passing, you don't give the chaff the same space you give to the tree. You don't give the opposition in this psalm the same force as you give to the positive. We as, I don't know, maybe, I would say we as evangelicals, or at least as conservatives, have a way of preaching the positive negatively. That is, if we're going to preach about purity, we'll talk about all the people who are not pure. You get a passage like 1 Peter 1, you know, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has begotten us to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance undefiled, it fades not away, that's reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God. I mean, that passage is brimming with hope, alive with expectation. The sentence is, you don't have that hope, do you? That's our problem, we don't have the hope. And instead of preaching it positively, we tend to come back and do it negatively. So you don't ever give the chaff the same safe space that you give to the tree. I spent a few minutes in my book and talked about all of this. I spent some time with it tonight because the most important single thing I can teach you is the anatomy of an idea. I find myself using this all the time. If I read a chapter of a book, I have to ask, all right, what's the subject? What's he talking about? And what is he saying about it? Some books are badly written. Articles are poorly put together, and you discover they don't have a central idea. It's just sort of buckshot. But good writers intuitively or deliberately are rounding out an idea. And for me to evaluate it, to write a review, I have to say, what's the subject? What's he talking about? What's his answer? And then I can ask, all right, what's he doing in the article? Is he explaining it? Is he proving it? Is he applying it? Does the proof stand up? But I can't even ask those questions unless I understand what the idea is. I have friends who use this in counseling. People come to you with problems. They don't have it all outlined. Roman numeral 1, you know. They come and just pour it all out. And you listen. Probably the greatest single skill you can develop as a counselor is listening. And sometimes you say to the person, okay, you're telling me that you think that all circumstances are against you. No. Okay. Let's try it again. As the proverb says, he who answers a matter before he hears it, to him it's a folly and shame. So what you do is to help the person to define the question. What is he talking about? And what he's saying about this. I find that very helpful because I listen to people and I don't know what to tell them. Life is all messed up. But I do try to find out what they're talking about. Many times after they're through and I say, I take it that you're saying that you're going to have to cut down your standard of living because you've lost some money in the stock market and you're really worried about that. So, is that right? Oh, yeah, that's it. Well, I don't know what to tell them. Reinvest your money. I mean, what do you say to them? What I have found, however, is that many times people will say, you know that time I spent? Boy, that was helpful. Not because I imparted great insight, but because they got their question and answer straight. You know how it is. When you worry about everything. You just can't worry in a narrow way. Worry about everything. I was, a year or so ago, one of the people in our counseling department said to me, how you doing? I said, all right. The person said, A, B, B minus, C plus. I said, well, probably a C plus. And they said, all right, what could I do or what can you do or what can anybody do to bring that up to a B? It was a great question. I mean, I was just sort of soaking in my misery. It was a great question. It's the kind of question that people in the counseling department ask. When you're writing, when you're preaching, when you're preaching that sermon, people ought to know what the idea is, what you're talking about, what you're saying about what you're talking about. This is a Robinson statistic, which means it has no empirical evidence. But I have a hunch that you could take 90%, 80% of the sermons preached on a Sunday morning, and the preacher couldn't answer those two questions. Couldn't tell you clearly what he's talking about. Couldn't tell you clearly what he's saying about what he's talking about. So of all the things I could teach you, work with you, this would be it. Tomorrow, when we get together, I want to talk to you about the way you would arrange a sermon so that people would respond to it. Preaching is listeners like it. I won't do to you tomorrow what I did tonight, force you to answer. But nobody ever started out to be boring. we do it easily, but we... So how can you avoid that? What can you do? Preachers, listeners like it. Let's pray. Father, you have told us that we are to love you with our hearts and souls and strength and with our minds. Help us, Lord. Help us to do that, especially with our minds.